I think the whole goal here for Iran is not so much punishment, but to reestablish the red line of deterrence. Right now, Israel feels that it can do anything, and it's acting as if it has the ability to do anything and pay no consequence. Deterrence means when I deter you, it's basically I'm saying that if you do something to me, the price you're going to pay is going to be so overwhelmingly bad for you that it's not worth coming at me to begin with. Israel obviously felt that it could take out this Iranian consulate. And so Iran needs to retaliate sufficiently so that Israel understands that in the future, should it do something like that, they understand that the price they're going to pay. So Israel has to pay a price. But what Iran doesn't want to do is over retaliate and create a situation where Israel has no choice now but to launch its own counter retaliation.
Yeah, baby. It's episode 151 of Ask the Inspector on April 16th, 2024. Jeff Norman with our favorite weapons inspector, Scott Ritter. The idea of starting off with that clip was not only to show Ryan, because we do want to take advantage of every opportunity to project such a handsome, muscular physique to the audience, but because Scott nailed it. What do you think, Scott? How closely did it play out to what you had envisioned?
100%, but there's, we're stuck in a situation. Look, I'll take full credit for getting it right, but we also have to acknowledge that we're in a difficult situation right now as we speak, because apparently Israel didn't get the message, because the war cabinet has just voted to authorize an Israeli retaliation against Iran under the assumption that Iran, they're just going to reach out and touch Iran like Iran touched them. But the Iranians have said any attack against Iran, any attack, will get a response tenfold. And apparently the Israelis didn't believe that. And apparently there was something about the soft approach taken by Iran that led the Israelis to believe that this was the best Iran could do. Iran wasn't going to be able to follow through. So we're not out of the woods yet. We're still in a very dangerous situation. Now, hopefully, Joe Biden and the U.S. Government will be able to make phone calls to Israel and put them on notice that, you're on your own. And if you do this, we're going to change the equation. Otherwise, if the United States continues to coddle Israel, Israel is going to operate under the false belief that it will it can continue to get away with literal murder. So we're in a very dangerous situation still, because I do believe that the Iranians are serious when they said if Israel attacks them, Iran will come in with overwhelming force. And it won't be a soft approach like they took previously. So we'll see.
All right. And you're doing a great job keeping up with the rapidly changing developments. Over the weekend, we published Missiles of April on Substack. That's at scottritterextra.com. And then today, a brand new article just published minutes ago, Checkmate. And you're saying that this has widespread ramifications, not only with respect to Israel and Iran, but also it exposes some vulnerabilities on a global level.
Well, the United States, I want to point out that the defense, the Nevatim air base that Iran struck, one of the two air bases that they struck, the other one being, I believe, at Ramona, are the most heavily defended spots on the planet when it comes to ballistic missile defense. There are multiple layers of interceptors, at least one American THAAD battery, maybe two, Patriots, American and Israeli, with missile intercept capability, the Arrow 2, the Arrow 3, David Sling. This provides with an entire layered defense system, all designed to defeat Iranian ballistic missiles. This is coupled with the ANTPY-2 X-band radar, which is the most advanced over-the-horizon surveillance radar in the world. And this is combined with Israeli capabilities that are also designed to detect and track missiles. We also plugged in, just so people know, what are called ballistic missile defense capable Aegis class destroyers, at least two, were plugged into this system, meaning they were brought up to the shores of Israel or into the Red Sea and integrated into this architecture, so that their radars and their missiles, together with the global capabilities of the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, satellites, etc., analytical capabilities, supercomputers, analysts, they were all brought in. This was, the United States operates under the assumption that we have created theater level ballistic missile capabilities that can offset advances in ballistic missile design by our potential adversaries. For instance, we have a ballistic missile defense architecture in Europe that's contingent upon Aegis Ashore, the two Aegis or nine Aegis destroyers out of Spain, plus a whole bunch of other ballistic missile intercept capability, THAAD, et cetera, radars there. And we say we can protect Europe from Russian ballistic missiles. In the Korean Peninsula, we have convinced the Japanese and the South Koreans that we have theater-based ballistic missile defense capabilities using the same assets that can protect against North Korea. And we're convincing the Taiwanese that we, of course, can protect them from Chinese ballistic missiles. What the Iranians just proved is that this entire architecture doesn't work, that the Iranians reached out and touched Nevatim Air Base at least five times out of seven attempts, despite it being the most heavily defended point on the planet. And if the Iranians can touch Nevatim, they can touch any aircraft carrier the United States deploys within range of Iranian missiles. They can destroy any American ship, any American base. But it's not just the Iranians. The Chinese can do the same thing. So can the North Koreans. So can the Russians. This just exposed the fatal flaw in America's global power projection system, where we say we can deploy power under the protective umbrella of a ballistic missile defense, and we can, you know, attack any place we want without consequence. And I think what the Iranians just showed is, no, the opposite will be true. When we attempt to project power aggressively, we expose all of our assets to, you know, what it's called AAA2, access. What's the AA? It's area denial. And then the AA is not Alcoholics Anonymous. It's something else, but it's in the article. But the bottom line is we are very exposed that these advancements in ballistic missile technology have exceeded our defense capabilities. And so it's like the Maginot Line. I mean, we should have learned the lesson from the Maginot Line. You can't build a perfect defense. If you build a perfect defense, what you think is a perfect defense, the enemy will always come up with a way to counter it. And, you know, this is a lesson that we learned back during the Cold War when we were pursuing ballistic missile defense. This is why we signed the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Why? What we realized is that all we end up doing by creating new defenses, offensive systems to beat them, new defenses, is A, we're bankrupting ourselves, and B, we're getting ourselves in a perpetual cycle of escalation that will inevitably lead to mutually assured destruction. So why don't we back up and just acknowledge up front, hey, we can kill each other. Therefore, there's no reason to have ballistic missile defense. And that way, you build your missiles to kill me, I build my missiles to kill you. We acknowledge we can kill each other. We don't fire our missiles. That's the way it needs to operate. And hopefully we can take a lesson from what happened here, instead of saying, well, we have to build new and better anti-ballistic missile capability, because all the Iranians will do is build better warheads to defeat them. And then we end up cycling up until we get the situation where we are now, where Israel feels it has no choice but to retaliate and there's going to be a larger war. It would be nice if both sides just admitted, hey, we can kill each other, so let's not. That would lead to peace breaking out all over, which would be a sort of a cool thing,
wouldn't it? Let's wage peace.
Game changers. Changes to the game such that the game can never be played the same way again.
Had to play it, Scott. Had to. This is the lightning round. We do it every Tuesday. Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. Backstage today, we're joined by both Yelena and Ryan, an embarrassment of riches. The first question comes from Jeffo in Cali. I guess previously I could have referred to myself that way.
I think this is you. You're just inserting your own question.
Very clever. I understand Iran's right to retaliate against Israel, but what do you think about the counterargument? Similar to the current events in Gaza having started well before October 7th, Israel can claim that it bombed Iran's sovereign territory because it's retaliating against Iran's years-long funding and support of its enemies.
What comes first, the chicken or the egg?
The egg.
Yeah, I can't be born without the chicken. But my point is, that's not the question we're asking here. There's no debating here. Israel has been in a veritable state of war against Iran for many, many decades now, especially, say, since 2001, when Israel helped cook up a scheme that accused Iran of having a nuclear weapons program when Israel knew, in fact, they didn't. But the purpose was to create the conditions that could lead to the sanctioning of Iran and the deposing of Iran. Israel has been viewing Iran since the Islamic Revolution as it's one of its top threats, and has been pursuing regime change options in Iran since that time. It's Israel that launched the Stuxnet virus attack. It wasn't Iran that launched a virus attack against Israel. It's Israel that assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists. It's Israel that's carried out direct action, blowing up critical infrastructure inside Iran. It's Israel that has been attacking Iran nonstop over the years. So knock off the bullshit. There is no equality here. Israel has been at war with Iran. Iran has not been at war with Israel. Anything Iran has done has been in response to Israeli aggression. It's defensive in nature. Stop blaming Iran for the sins of Israel. I don't cut Israel any slack on this one.
Next question. Well, hold on. Let's get it done this way. Next question is from Jeff, who misspelled his name for some reason. Hagopian in Vista, California. Another Jeff in California. What's your understanding of the disposition of the Armenian community in Jerusalem?
Well, first of all, I'll respond by saying I am not an expert on the Armenian community in Jerusalem. So if my answer is insufficient or somehow lacks the specificity that you're probably hoping for, please forgive me. What I will say,
though, dare you?
How dare you? What I will say is that I've been to Jerusalem and I've seen the Armenian churches there. And I recognize that the Armenian Christian community is one of the oldest Christian communities, not only in the world, but in Jerusalem. They're very well established in Jerusalem. And that they have been subjected to bullying, intimidation, and otherwise less than friendly attitude by Israelis who resent Christian presence in the city where the temple is, not only the old temple's there, but that's where they want to build the new temple. So I think the Armenian community finds itself in a similar boat as the Muslim community, indeed any non-Jewish community in Jerusalem, where they are subjected to abuses by the Israelis. So hopefully that's the correct answer. That's my understanding. And if you want to send a message out that says, bullshit, Scott, you got it wrong. The Armenians are the most loved community and they break bread with the Israelis every night, I'll stand corrected. But I've been talking to Armenian Christians who have connectivity with the community in Jerusalem. And my understanding is that they are subjected to a lot of bullying and abuse, especially during the Christmas and Easter holidays, two of the biggest religious holidays in Christianity. The Israeli government, Israeli settlers, Israelis in general, have come in and done intimidation, disrupted services, and committed acts of violence against the Armenian Christians.
All right, let's check in with Larry C. Johnson and see if he thinks you got it right.
I mean, I agree with Scott.
All right.
Thanks, Larry.
Sarah Allard from the Netherlands. If the U.S. does support an Israel retaliation, Russia will side with Iran. Does this mean Russia and or Iran will target American cities with missiles and bombs?
No. Now, we could leave it at that, but no, Russia's not going to attack America. It's suicide, just like America's not going to attack Russia. Put my hand in front, get the...
Oh, I thought you were waving to me.
I was, but I was also trying to correct the drunken camera. I have a camera that gets drunk every once in a while, and it loses focus. But we don't know the scope and scale of Russia's commitment, but what Russia's trying to do is stave off irresponsible Israeli behavior. I think Russia understands what I have alluded to at the beginning of the show, that there's a real threat that Israel's going to launch some sort of attack. And that if Iran's going to have any deterrence policy worthy of the name, Iran will have to respond decisively. And at that point in time, what is left for Israel? Israel can't launch a sustained attack of any meaningful capacity against Iran. They lack the ability. They need the United States. But if the United States gets involved, I think what Russia is saying is that they will step in. They're not going to let the United States impose its will on Iran. Iran is a strategic ally of Russia. And so you might see Russian Air Force squadrons deployed to Tehran, where they will confront Israel and American air power, daring them to fight the Russians. You may see Russian air defense deployed into the region to protect Iran. And then if they want to escalate, then they escalate. They run the risk of having, Russian weapon systems. It doesn't take very long for a MiG-31 equipped with a Kinzhal missile to make it to Iranian airspace and add its firepower to the weight of what Iran already has. So, again, this is a very, very dangerous situation, a very dangerous situation where we can have, what should have been a done deal. This should have been done. Israel and Iran should have called it a day, turn into not just a regional conflict, but a global conflict.
Doran K. in London asks the following question. Could you please tell us about how Marwan Barghouti could unite Palestinians, including socialists, Muslims, and Christians? And why does everyone respect him?
I cannot answer this question. I have peripheral knowledge of who Marwan Barghouti is, but I don't have sufficient depth of knowledge about him and his background, his connectivity with the aforementioned communities to be able to give you a responsible answer. But Jeff and I have this wonderful device that we call an asterisk. And we're going to put that on that question. And Scott's going to go off and spend his time now, instead of researching threats of the world and all this stuff, I'm going to dig into Marwan Barghouti, because I respect the question. You came on the show, you asked the question. I respect that, and I will do my best to get you an answer.
All right. And note to self, that was question number four. Question number four. We will follow up on that.
Well, wait, we got two producers in the background. You'd think be able to pick up on this.
All right. Well, we have the question itself. We have the question number, and we have the audience to remind us. So there's no excuse. Moving on to what one might call question number five. Expat 84 in Toronto. If war between Iran and Israel spreads, how do you think Iran's recent detente with the Saudis and other Gulf states would impact Iran's military options? Specifically, would it result in striking U.S. bases or oil installations in the Gulf states or closing the Straits of Hormuz?
Well, you make the same mistake I do, Expat 84. The Straits of Hormuz. I've been saying that forever.
I looked that up and I saw a bunch of it with straits and I saw a bunch of straight singular. I saw it both ways.
Well, I was corrected a while back by somebody who I respect, and they said it's the Strait of Hormuz. It could be the Straits. I don't know. It's like I have to go watch Princess Bride all over again in the Straits of Despair or something like that. I don't know.
Well, we have two producers backstage, so I'm sure they can get to the bottom of it.
They can find it. Straight on. Look, Iran has made it clear that it is not seeking a wider confrontation. Iran has also been working with China and Russia to improve relations with its Gulf Arab neighbors. This is why China was able to broker a reconciliation, a rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And Iran has similarly cordial relations with other Gulf Arab states, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, etc. And Iran's not looking for a fight. You also have to understand that any Iran action against oil producing or storage infrastructure in the region, Saudi, Kuwaiti, Emirati, will inevitably lead to similar strikes against Iranian production and vice versa. And that's basically each side cutting their own throats. Nobody wants that. This is why many nations in the region, Strait of Hormuz. Thank you, Zonderbach.
Yeah, well, look at the source.
Wikipedia.
So that settles it. That settles it. It's plural.
Yeah, well, there we go. Wikipedia says it's singular. It must be plural. But the fact of the matter is, Iran has put everybody on notice, including the United States, that as long as you don't participate in the Israeli action, we won't touch you. But here's the problem. If the United States decides to participate, how do they limit it? Because once Americans use a base, let's say out of Kuwait, Iran has said all bases are now open up, which means now Iran will strike Qatar, Iran will strike the UAE or any place where American bases are. Now, if they limit that to the base, does that nation, the host nation, say, well, that's okay, you just blew up the Americans on our territory, but we don't care? Or will they now trigger some sort of collective defense agreement where they get involved and now the whole area blows up? Iran will shut down oil production, gas production, and the Strait of Hormuz or Straits of Hormuz, you know, if need be. So it's a very dangerous situation. Last thing, 14 seconds left. Joe Biden has reduced the American Strategic Petroleum Reserve to 17 days. That means we're going to run out of fuel very fast.
Oh, you got it. Isn't there some treaties that are often referred to? What am I thinking of that in the singular, but that are actually plural? You know what I'm talking about?
I don't know. I mean, I guess you could say the Treaty of Westphalia, which is comprised of four separate treaties, but I don't think so. I don't know.
It's something that's more famous. All right.
Yeah, no, I'm making that name up. I mean, I know there was a treaty. I'm making it up. That's all.
Oh, all right. Paul Peters in Canada. Why has no one asked for a breakdown of the proposed $60 billion in aid to Ukraine? Things like what items will be sent in the first 4 weeks, then the next 3 months, and so on. If the U.S. is maxed out in weapons production, how are they going to spend that money?
Well, according to the internet, and right off the bat, we have to be suspect, a piece of paper fell out of Speaker Mike Johnson's pocket over the weekend that laid out exactly what you said. I saw a photograph on the internet that allegedly was, you know, derived of a paper produced from the notes of somebody in the room where Speaker Johnson talked about various legislation he wanted to get through about the different aid packages to Ukraine, Israel, etc. And the Ukrainian and all of them were broken out, not in, you know, immense detail, but it did answer the basic questions you had. The money that would be released for replenishing stocks for new production for Ukraine, for immediate purchasing for Ukraine to fund the Ukrainian government, things of that nature. So I think the answer is there. And I do think if you go into the details of the Senate bill and the House bill, you'll find even more details on, you know, how this money is supposed to be spent and along what timeline. So I think the question has been answered. It's out there.
If only there were a senator or somebody in prominent position who would ask questions like that, who cared to keep track of how the money was spent. If only there were somebody.
And some might say, well, you know, it's for a good cause. Well, shouldn't we examine what they're going to spend it on? Shouldn't we have like a special inspector general, someone who's trained to look for waste? Shouldn't we have that person appointed to look at the waste? I've advocated it for over a year. I've forced them to vote on it. The Democrats all voted no, and all the big government Republicans who love this money, they voted no too. They don't want scrutiny of how the money's being spent. I even helped them to pick who would be the inspector general. Somebody's been doing it for 10 years.
And that guy's name was, wasn't that guy's name Peter Paul or Paul Peter? You should know Rand Paul, another guy with two first names.
At least it's not Mary.
Yeah, right.
I like, you see, Matt Backey just pointed up something. You know, this is the second time I heard that I was contacted by somebody from Iran that said that a tweet that I had sent out had gone viral. I mean, everybody was talking about the tweet. So apparently, if I went to Iran, while they couldn't buy me a beer, they might buy me a Diet Coke. I might be popular in Iran right now. Now, we can wait a week. I might say something that changes all of that. But at the moment, I'm apparently popular in Iran. So,
all right. Aren't you pretty much popular everywhere except the U.S.? No, you're popular. Well,
I mean, there's certain parts of the U.S. I'm popular. I understand there's a certain steelworkers union in Long Island where I might have a certain level of popularity. But, yeah, I think I think in Europe there's some pockets of people who hate me as well. I've been very cruel to the Germans lately. In Georgia, my wife's native country, I've spoken out about this foreign agents, not about, I'm in favor of a foreign agent registration act legislation that's in place because it would expose how the United States and the European Union has corrupted Georgian society with money. Sort of the Georgian equivalent of, say, Citizens United. But bing. Sorry. But the Georgia right now is undergoing a crisis of identity where there are powers trying to drag it into a conflict with Russia. And we'll see what happens with the legislation. But if I went to Georgia today, there might be some Georgians who don't like me. There might be some Italians that don't like me in Italy, et cetera. So I think Europe, I'd have to tread carefully. But if I get outside of Europe into the global South, Russia, maybe China, who knows? Maybe one day we'll actually travel to China and find out if the Chinese like me.
Somebody should make a map on where is it safe for Scott to roam.
Well, just speaking, you have to keep in mind that the Ukrainians have a hit out on me, an active hit on several levels. And I smile about it, but it's real. So it's something that, you know, one does have to keep in mind. I was invited to go to Romania and they're like, come to Romania and speak. And I'm like, Romania is like next door to Ukraine. You got a lot of Ukrainians there. And I'm thinking it could be I should just buy a one-way ticket to Romania. Is that what you're telling me?
All right. Well, you mentioned steelworkers. Our next question, perfect segue. Phil in Manchester. With the China bashing, Joey stated that Chinese steel is bad and implied a connection with the Baltimore Bridge collapse. But the steel for the Baltimore Bridge came from the Pittsburgh Des Moines Steel Company and won awards, according to an article in the Pittsburgh Trib.
Well, I don't know what Joey said. I didn't take it. What I thought what he was saying is that we don't want to use Chinese steel to rebuild the Key Bridge. That if the Key Bridge is going to be rebuilt, it's going to be done with American steel. Now, here's the question I have. Is this Phil, my favorite Phil?
I don't know. I don't think so.
All right. So I won't say it facetiously. But Phil in Manchester, what I would ask, and maybe I'll tell you, we have two producers. So let's find out if this Des Moines Steel Company still produces steel. Are they still around? Because I think the Francis Scott Key Bridge has been around for a while. And I imagine since the time it was built, many steel factories in America have gone out of business because American steel is too expensive. And so they brought in cheaper Chinese steel. So I think Joey's concerns are real. And I would imagine that if the Des Moines Steel Company is not in business, or even if it was, it still might be too expensive. And so budget-minded people might say, we have to buy Chinese steel. And then the question is Joey accurate when he says Chinese steel is not up to the quality of the steel that was formerly produced by the Des Moines Steel Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania? So these are important issues. But no matter what, I think we all should stand by American steel workers to insist that critical American infrastructure is built with American steel. I have nothing against the Chinese. I'm all for good trade, but just like the Chinese, I think, would want good Chinese steel to produce their high-speed rail systems, Americans should want good American steel to produce to build their critical infrastructure. I think we can all agree on that, whether we are Phil from Manchester, Joey from Long Island, or Scott from Del Mar.
Or Joey's from Delaware, right?
No, isn't I thought Joey was our steelworker.
Oh, I thought he meant Biden. Oh, he meant...
He might be, because you're right, Chris is our steelworker. Who the hell, like, Chris, don't hit me. I'm sorry, I conflated.
No, his name is Charles.
Charles, it begins with a C. I knew that.
Yeah, yeah. He was talking about Biden.
Come on, man.
Yeah, Joey, you're right. He was talking about Joey Biden.
All right. Let's take a phone call. Hey, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector. What is your very good question for him?
Hi, Jeff. It's Mark here from Ireland. Hi, Mark. And hi, Scott. I have a good question, I think, anyway. Whose line is the... Lloyd Austin lying when he says there's no genocide in Palestine on the 9th, or is Samantha Power, who turned around the next day and said that there's a famine? It's just a curious thing, which one of the State Department people are actually lying about the facts on the ground, famine or no genocide? It's a sort of a curious little thing that they can't even get their story right.
All right. Thanks. Well,
I would imagine that Samantha Power will say there's a famine, but it's not genocide. See, genocide, in order to be called genocide, has to be a specific, for instance, let's take a look at the way the International Court of Justice framed it. You have to have a decision by a government body to commit acts of genocide against a Palestinian. That's targeted annihilation, eradication of a people. Then that guidance has to be given to an entity that understands the guidance for what it is and then takes action on it. And then you have a policy of genocide, which, if implemented, would lead to actual genocide. Many people have articulated that this is what Israel has done. South Africa and others articulated very well before the International Court of Justice. I happen to be on their side and believe that what Israel is doing today is genocide. Lloyd Austin and others, including Tony Blinken and John Kirby and Jake Sullivan, have all said, no, this isn't genocide that's taking place. It's not genocide. It's just the Israelis have made mistakes. Now, Samantha Power is saying there's famine. What we're trying to say is that even though the Israelis haven't carried out a policy of genocide, that the Israeli policy of denying humanitarian aid to the Palestinians is misguided, and it's led to a situation where famine has erupted inside Gaza, and we need to rectify it. But the famine is not a byproduct of genocide. You see how they work? Now, we all know this is BS. We all know that the Israelis have committed genocide, are committing genocide, and that a byproduct of this genocidal policy is the famine that's undergoing, because famine is one of the ways, including disease and direct action, kinetic action, dropping bombs, that lead to the death of people. And of course, genocide is about killing off the population. So, Samantha Power is right. There is famine. But she should link it to genocidal policies, but she won't. And Lloyd Austin is wrong. The Israelis are, in fact, committing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza.
All right. Now comes our favorite steelworker, sometimes known as Chris, but his name is actually Charles. Hello, Charles.
How you doing? Jeff? I just wanted to comment on my way home. I'm listening to the show. So can you hear me? If you do, I'm going to keep going.
Hold it. Not only can we hear you, we can see you. You sent me a picture of you and your boyfriend.
Oh, yeah. That's right there at Times Square.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just wanted to point out that Scott's right. We're dealing with two different generations. The Francis Scott Bridge was built 47 years ago. It's not even 50 years old. The Brooklyn Bridge was built over 100 years ago. The manpower and the men at that time produced steel. They produced iron. That's why that bridge stands. That barge would hit the Brooklyn Bridge or the Golden Gate Bridge. By the way, Tom Cotton has a different opinion about bridges. He wants to throw off protesting civilians who he calls criminals, but that's another story. Anyway, it's a different generation. 1977 iron workers aren't my grandfather. It's a different generation. That's what I said. We need to, and also the program we have, okay, helmets to hard hats. Who do you think does that type of work? Former Marines, former military. And they get a scholarship into the program and they're paid. So this helps us. And this is what America needs, that manpower, just like Russia. I mean, Russia is like a carbon copy of what men were at the age of my father and grandfather. So that's my point, that we're dealing, we have to reorganize everything. And that's what we're trying to do. And as far as the Francis Scott Bridge, now I hear the FBI is involved. So it's the engineering was, if you look at it, it was terrible. And thank you. So Scott, thank you. And Jeff, thank you for everything you guys do. And I will be in touch. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Thanks. Take care, Charles.
You know what? While he was speaking and he talked about Russia, I don't want to say one of this. I don't want to give away any aspect of our itinerary in Russia for obvious reasons. But there's a chance we could be going to steel towns in Russia, places that are like Pittsburgh used to be. And, you know, I think that a Russian steel worker would be a Russian-speaking version of Charles. I think real men who are patriotic, hardworking, with a solid work ethic, and just good people. And wouldn't it be cool if we could put American steelworkers together with Russian steelworkers around a bar where they could drink beer and vodka in a nonviolent setting and controlled atmosphere, but let them just talk steel. Let them talk about what it means to make steel, what
you
it
should definitely do that
to build it. So, Charles, if you're listening, keep that in mind that, maybe we can at some point in time find a way to get a delegation of steelworkers from your union to go to Russia and meet Russian steelworkers and get a tour. And then if everything's ever turn around, maybe get some Russian steelworkers to come to America, meet American steelworkers, do a tour of American steel plants, and we can create this kind of human-to-human contact that we need so that we stop wanting to fight each other and kill each other and learn how to live together in peace and prosperity.
All right. Well, I'm glad you're worried about security. I am too. In fact, I have a disguise that I'm planning to bring so that people don't even recognize me. Let me show you. What do you think of this? Will this be effective in Russia?
For one day. Yeah.
For one day. All right. That cost me $12, by the way.
Well, money well spent.
I don't know. I don't know if I got a $12 payoff from it.
If people are out there who can donate or contribute, please, somebody kick in $12 to compensate Jeff for that purchase.
Well, I'd put it a different way. If there are people out there who laughed, let me know. So then I'll know I got my $8 or $12 worth. The next question is from either Ado or Addo in Malta. Traits of the West being a bad loser are being shown throughout. Do you think that if or when Russia takes control of Kharkov and Odessa, the bad losers would try to convince their populations and fellow ignorant politicians that it would be good to use nukes on Russian forces in Ukraine?
No. No. Straight up no. That's like me saying, do y'all want to commit suicide? Because that's what it is, committing suicide. Look, Russia's won this thing. It's over. I mean, the collapse is happening. Every time I, Billy Lil Mike 8531, pay
my
up.
New best friend. My new best friend.
Pay up. It's $12 to laugh. but, we're not going to go to nuclear war. Ukraine's lost. The whole world is coming to grips with this loss. Look, France tried to sneak in some troops and some Caesar artillery systems. Russia blew them up, killed them right off the bat. That's the fate of all French troops going to Ukraine. The fate of any foreign troops going to Ukraine. They will all die. Russia, the Ukrainians are just in pure panic right now because there's nothing they can do to stop the Russians. The Russians just keep moving, and everybody sees that the Russians are building up the force. And once the weather gets a little bit decent and the ground becomes a little bit harder, the Russians are just going to dramatically change the way the battlefield map looks to the detriment of Ukraine. So that's where we are. I just also, I saw somebody in their question. I know I'm not supposed to read them, Jeff. Please forgive me. I do read the comments.
Oh, I forgive you. Don't you worry about it. Should I stop the clock? Are you done with that question?
I'm done with that question. It is a Colonel McGregor question, but it was a facetious question, but I thought it was pretty funny. Who would win in a street fight between me and Colonel McGregor? And I will tell you that the answer is Colonel McGregor, because all he would have to do is yell attention. I would stand to attention, where he would proceed to beat the living crap out of me because he never took me out of attention, and I couldn't defend myself because I have to obey the orders of a superior officer. So there it is, a street fight between me and Colonel McGregor. He wins. Now, I'll put it this way. If one of you challenge Colonel McGregor and I'm next to his side, you're going to lose, not because of anything he does, but I stand by superior officers and I defend them with my life. So unless you're willing to take me on in a life and death struggle, leave Colonel McGregor alone.
All right. I'm not sure if that was a trick question or a trick answer, but anyway, it was a good one. Raw Manca 13 in Kansas. Does the United States military have deep underground military bases? And Raw Manca 13 says, I thought Ryan and Scott had a good ebb and flow going on when Jeff's internet was down. That's what happened last Friday. I agree.
Well, what was happening last Friday is that Ryan was running a soft coup. he conspired to have Jeff's internet taken out, and then he wanted to come in and do a proof of concept because he was sending me frantically. I'll send them to you, Jeff. He was sending me text messages all the time. I'm better than Jeff, aren't I? I'm better than Jeff, aren't I? Let me be the new Jeff. Let me be the new Jeff. And I was like, dude, you can't do that, man. You don't have the history of me and Jeff. You can't just step in like that. But, you know, Ryan, I forgave him because I think he was drunk at the time. So I was like, yeah, you're a little emotional alcohol.
That's why I call you my favorite weapons inspector. What a guy.
He was trying to do a coup d'etat there. But no, Ryan did a very good job. That's why, well, there's a number of reasons why we like Ryan, but one of the attributes that he has is he's very competent. It was the vodka. Deep underground facilities. Cheyenne Mountain is the living example of a deep underground facility design. It's basically the NORAD, the North America Air Defense headquarters. Now it's might be some sort of combined strategic command air, but it's built into a mountain, literally. And it's built on giant springs designed to absorb the shock of a nuclear blast. To get to it, you have to go through tunnels that open up and go all the way into the interior of the mountain and things of that nature. And I imagine that we have bunkers. This is where I can't talk too much anymore. I would imagine, and the reason why I say I imagine is that they have revealed, for instance, in West Virginia, the existence of a facility. And I trained at one. It was pretty cool. When I went to the Baltimore Fire Department conference, they took us to a facility that had been a former top secret American underground facility for the continuance of government and all this stuff. And we did a train derailment exercise there because the politicians or whoever they're trying to save would come in by train before being led into this deep underground bunker of rooms and everything. So that one existed. And there's another one in West Virginia that exists where they do similar training. If others existed, I couldn't tell you. But those two definitely existed. And one could hypothesize the potential of an entire network of underground facilities in and around Washington, D.C., where people would flee to in times of conflict. And one would imagine that the military has a similar system where people go underground in case of nuclear war to ride out the nuclear war. So there's that answer. 26.
For those of you who want to see more of Ryan, you will have your opportunity tomorrow night. Following the Scott Ritter Show, Ryan and I will begin workshopping a brand new podcast that we're tentatively calling The Feedback Loop. And every Wednesday night, Scott is the interviewer. He is the host with various notables from Russia. And that streams at 9 p.m. Eastern time every Wednesday night. Tomorrow night's episode, I'm shocked, Scott. You're such a serious guy. You interviewed a couple of comedians, a couple of pranksters. That's what tomorrow night's show is, Vovan and Lexus.
But they're more than just pranksters. These are guys that have a meaningful impact on the world. For instance, we wouldn't know about Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande's admission that Maidan was a sham if it weren't for Vovan and Lexus, who pranked them into admitting that. They just did a wonderful prank against the head of the Olympic Committee, where he all but admitted he's gleeful that Russia's kept out, that this says, you know, this is about Russophobic policies, not about anything real. Rumor has it that they just pranked Mike Pompeo. You know, but they have pranked a number of people, and in doing so, even though there's an element of humor in what they do, they actually are just as effective, or even more so in some of cases, than Julian Assange was when he leaked the Hillary Clinton emails. You know, the ones that exposed the fact that Hillary Clinton's a liar, and all of American policymakers are a liar, that they released the cables that contradicted official policy statements made by the United States. See, somebody had to break the law, Chelsea Manning or Bradley Manning or whatever you want to call that individual. And Chelsea, today it's Chelsea, so I should respect that. So I do respect that. And released it. But Chelsea had to go to jail because of that. You know, what these two gentlemen from Russia are doing is, it's purely legal. They're just calling up and getting you to talk. And yeah. And these idiots are talking to them and revealing stuff. Just to put you on notice, Jeff, that we will be in St. Petersburg. We can release that location because we are going to the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum in June. And guess who's going to be at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum? Yes, you need to wear that.
Well, Putin, Judge Knapp, Lexus and
and so we are going to have to hang out with these guys for a night and maybe do a podcast with them live, and maybe we can watch them prank somebody live on our podcast.
Oh yeah, we should do it. Let's collaborate on a prank while we're at the forum.
Well, let's do that. But I'm just saying that they're open to that that suggestion, but they're just really two really good guys. Although they are comedians, they're very serious about the work they do, and the level of preparation that goes into these pranks is.
It's actually a legitimate form of journalism. I really, I used to do a lot of hidden camera pranks, so I know that if you play it straight, you can get people to believe almost everything, and they have the advantage of being able to imitate people. I mean, that's
well, they do thing. Right, but they do it without any artificial intelligence. It's all straight up old school stuff. Mm-hmm. One of the things that they added to their prank was a visual element of it. They one of them was made up to be African gentleman. So they were calling the head of the Olympic Committee from Africa, exploiting the man's ignorance of Africa and belief that the Africans would be Russophobic. But when they turned on the camera, he was an African, and the head of the Olympic Committee was like, "Oh, okay, so you're from Nigeria, okay, da 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 da." So they've added a visual element to their prank as well.
All right, well, maybe you can help us tomorrow night. First of all, let me clarify for the audience. The Scott Ritter Show streams on Rumble, Twitch, X, and I think that's it, right? And that's from 9 to about 9:45, depending on exactly when it ends. So right after that, Ryan and I are going to be on only Twitch because we're workshopping this. We don't really want a huge audience, but for those of you who want to check it out, we'd like some audience, something more than zero, but not a big audience because we're just getting started. So maybe you can help us out, Scott, and identify a couple of these pranks, either video or audio ones, and we can play them tomorrow night after the episode.
Absolutely. I'll do my best to do my duty to guide my country to help. Oh, wait a minute. Wrong oath.
All right. Sancho Relaxo, I guess it is, in Northern Ontario. Kofor Black, ex-CIA and ex-Blackwater vice chairman, is the other big name on the Burisma Board of Governors that we know. Could he be not only the financial intermediary, but also more deeply implicated in the Crocus City attack?
The operative word in that paragraph is could.
Could.
And the answer is yes, he could be. But I don't know if he is. Burisma has, of course, what the relevance of this question is that the Russians have uncovered a connection between Burisma and the funding that was used by the terrorists for the Crocus City Hall attack. Burisma is a notorious money laundering venture. It's a criminal enterprise. That's how, you know, Hunter Biden was on their board, even though he had no skill set, none whatsoever. His sole job was to facilitate, you know, telephonic connectivity between the Ukrainians and Joe Biden. Well, there you go. And, you know, so anything's possible. Kofor Black is human scum. There, Kofor, I said it. Now, I know you're a dangerous man, Kofor. You're a CIA officer, after all. And if you ever want to meet me in a bar and talk about why the fact I called you human scum live on TV, I'm more than happy to make that happen. Like the Iranians, I will tell you that I will not initiate offensive action, but I will retaliate the living shit out of you, you scumbag, piece of dirt, awful human being. There. Sorry, I don't like Kofor Black. There's reasons. If you go into his history and his resume with the CIA, you'll understand why. He's a dirtball. But he's perfect for Burisma, perfect for Burisma. And therefore, could is the operative word. It's all feasible. I can't say that it actually happened, though. First of all, I don't know the details of the Russian information, nor will Russia share that with me because it could give away sources and methods. But I trust the Russian information, but without more details, it would be difficult for me to surmise what role, if any, Kofor Black could have played in this. But it's perfect. He's a CIA guy. Once you're at that level in the CIA, you're never out of the CIA, meaning that you're always an intermediary. You're always a phone call away from connectivity. People are always calling upon you for advice or, you know, to discuss or for assistance. And so he's the perfect kind of guy that could be brought on a short-term contract to facilitate the flow of money out of Burisma into, you know, a Tajik entity that's linked to ISIS-K that could carry out the attacks on Crocus City Hall. Perfect, but I can't prove it.
I mean, I agree with Scott.
Thank you, Larry.
Well, Larry's former CIA. He should know, right?
Well, but Larry's not a dirtball.
Maslin in Malaysia, in your discussions with the Russians during your visits, did the topic of General Surovikin ever come up? If it did, what is really the story with him? Where is he now? Has he been demoted?
Yes, the topic of General Surovikin did come up often. What is the real story behind him? Some of the conversations I had were in confidence, meaning that if these people agreed to talk to me, I would forever keep it in confidence, and I have to respect that. So I'm afraid that I can't come up with the real story behind him because, A, I couldn't tell you if it was the real story. I could only say that it was a version of the story given to me by somebody who was in a position to know the real story, but might also be motivated not to reveal every fact to me. And the other thing is I promised this person or persons that I wouldn't talk about it. So now let's go to part three of that question. I answered the first two parts. There was a third part to that question. No, not the Bering Strait. Yes. Has he been demoted? He's dead. Where is he now?
That's a severe demotion.
He's dead. He got blown up in an airplane. He's dead. Now there's some people that believe that he's actually still in hiding in Africa, that this was all some sort of grand ploy, and that I was thinking Prigozhin. Boom. Okay, so now I can talk because I was talking Prigozhin, not Surovikin. Reset the clock, Jeff, because I was. Well, come on, man. This is what happens when you get a 60.
With all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey.
I agree. It's malarkey. I was sitting here doing Prigozhin, and you were talking Surovikin.
All right. Well, restart the clock. There you go.
So I had peripheral conversations about Surovikin because, I mean, you know, We talked about him, you know, some aspects of his background when he was in Moscow during the original 1993 revolt. He was a Russian tank commander at that time. He got arrested by Yeltsin for putting down he was loyal to the coup plotters. Yeltsin arrested him, kicked him out of the military, but then eventually he was brought back in because everybody said he was obeying his orders, that he was an honorable man. We talked about I guess he was in Tajikistan with some of the people that I met, and he was involved there. They had nothing but respect for him as a military leader. And of course he was widely regarded in his role in building the defenses that stopped the Ukrainian advance in 2023. He was given a task of coordinating with Prigozhin when it came to Prigozhin's complaints about ammunition starvation. Serovokin was appointed to be the intermediary, and as a result, he had very good relations with Prigozhin. And Prigozhin sort of took advantage of these relations when he carried out his attempted coup d'etat. And Serovikin was caught in the middle, tried his best to play the role of intermediary. Many people believe that he had advance notice of what Serovikin was, or what Prigozhin was getting ready to do, and that he tried to talk Prigozhin out of it, but wasn't able to. But now in retrospect, the Russians are like, well, you knew about it, but you didn't tell your upper command. Were you part of this? So it led to his detention, investigation. He was cleared of any wrongdoing, but not able to return to the front. So they sent him to Africa, where he became sort of the Russian guy that's running the introduction of Russian security into the African continent. He's talking with African leaders about this. And my understanding is that, Africa is his theater of operations right now. I believe he's probably returned to Russia several times for consultations, but that he's returned to Africa and he's still in Africa. But again, I could be wrong on that. But his job right now is to help facilitate Russian security interests in the African continent.
Dmitry in Russia. Do you think that when our countries really begin to understand and respect each other, a gas pipeline will be built from Russia to Alaska through the Bering Strait? Does it even make sense? Does Alaska need cheap gas?
It doesn't make any sense. Alaska doesn't need cheap gas. Alaska burns off gas. Alaska is a major oil producer and gas producer. So, no, that doesn't make sense. But improving relations with Russia and the United States, talking about the connectivity of Siberia with Alaska, does make sense. In fact, I'm hoping to introduce Jeff to a wonderful gentleman who had written a book about just that, the Siberian Alaskan Company, the Russian Alaskan Company, and a man who took a trip on boat from Lake Baikal to Alaska. And documented, wrote a book about it. And, he believes that there's a natural connectivity between the Russians of Siberia and the Americans of Alaska, and that connectivity could lead to an improvement of our relations. But I don't think you're going to get a gas pipeline built. One, it's not needed. And two, it's very expensive. And three, even if it was needed, getting Americans to take Russian gas, that might be a little too big of an ask. Even at this stage, I want to improve relations, but I mean, we have to be realistic of what we can and can't accomplish. Getting rid of nuclear weapons? Yeah, baby. Getting Americans to buy cheap Russian gas? We're not there yet.
Did you just say, yeah, baby?
I did say, yeah, baby. Is that a crime?
No. It's good. I like it when you say that.
Yeah, baby.
Well, I said, yeah, baby. I didn't say, yeah, baby. Now, there was a gentleman from Slovenia, I believe, in the questions who asked, would I be willing to be interviewed by a Slovenian audience? And the answer is yes. So if you're reading this, send Jeff an email and we'll make that happen.
All right. Sounds good. So that'll do it for this week's episode of Ask the Inspector. We keep it to about an hour on Tuesdays, and Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. Join us Friday night for the loquacious version. Two glorious hours of Scott answering questions quite extensively and me looking sexy as hell. And in the meanwhile, I hope you will go to our Substack and subscribe if you haven't already. The two most recent articles are The Missiles of April, which was published over the weekend, and just before we started today's stream, Checkmate. It's about the game-changing military action that Iran just demonstrated within the last few days. Tomorrow night, the Scott Ritter Show at 9 p.m. It's on Rumble, Locals, Twitch, and X. And an interview with Vovan Lexis, the world-renowned pranksters, followed by Ryan Milton and yours truly on Twitch only, workshopping our new podcast. And you sounded, I can tell you want to say something, Scott.
Just Yasko, since I brought it up and Yasko asked where he could get the email. Hey, Yasko, if you have trouble getting the email, since you're on X, I see you're an X guy. Oh, you found it. Never mind. Thank you for the podcast. I don't need to say anymore because Yasko solved his own problem without my intervention.
All right. A resourceful young human. We like that. Thanks to both Yelena and Ryan who helped us out backstage today. Thanks to our beloved audience. And thanks, as always, to my favorite weapons inspector and yours, William S. Ritter Jr., a.k.a. Scotty Boy.
Scotty Boy.
Take care.
And Maverick.